Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650 with Jamie Dodd and Thomas Drantz. Canucks Talk is brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at DLEAMC.com. We're live from the Kintec studio. Kintec, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews, sore feet. What are you waiting for? 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. The Stanley Cup final has shifted back to Florida. Game five is tomorrow night. Panthers with another chance to close this one out. And we are now joined from Hockey Night in Canada and Sportsnet covering this series. He is Kyle Bukauskas. Kyle, thanks for doing this. How are you today?
Hey, good, guys. How are we doing back on the coast?
We're doing very well, and I got to ask. So we've heard on a couple of different media appearances from Elliot Friedman that you've been on chauffeur duty for him today. Is he at least a good tipper, Kyle, if he's making you drive him around everywhere?
Yeah, that's the one thing I asked. It was five stars and a decent decent tip. So, man, news travels fast back there, eh? Oh, my gosh. It's funny. I've done two of his two hits where he's appeared on FaceTime out west there where I've been driving and he's in the car with me over the years there. So it's happy to do it. But the thing, then he goes, he sits, like, I really feel like a chauffeur because he sits in the back seat and there's nobody in the front seat with me. But that's okay. I think distance from Elliot is never a bad thing either.
Hey, as long as he's leaving the five-star rating, right? Then everything
that's
is good.
Exactly.
All right. So I think the big question going into Game 5 tomorrow is, what, if anything, will the Game 4 blowout, not just a loss, right, but a true blowout, what will it mean carrying over, again, if anything, to Game 5 tomorrow night?
Yeah, it's funny. I've never felt, you know, covering playoff series that anything from one game to the next really carries over, unless, you know, you're talking an injury or a suspension to a key player that suddenly they're not part of a lineup, and then that can change things for sure. But I was talking to Kevin Bieksa at the rink there today, and I didn't, he volunteered this. I would not bring this up to him, but you know, talking about going in the Boston there for game three and similar, you know, 8-1 being blown out. And he felt that was even more so than the, you know, the Aaron Rome, Nathan Horton hit. He goes, that's where things really started to shift how Vancouver felt about that series being blown out the way they did in game three. Now, that was to make it 2-1, you know, not 3-1 here like we have in Edmonton and Florida. But you know, I once I heard that, I thought, okay, well, now I'm curious to see if Florida will look any different coming out of the gate here tomorrow night. But they seem, I mean, you know, you can always read into the off-day practice how you want. Oh, they look really loose, or they look kind of tight and nervous and not as much chatter as you would see. But they seem like they were very much themselves. At one point in the practice, you know, Bobrovsky, after being pulled in four there, makes this unbelievable paddle save reaching across his crease, and the whole team erupts, and you know, it was a good moment there. Going into the room afterwards, there was an episode of Friends being played on the video wall there in their dressing room. So they seem like a relaxed group that, you know, I think you know, as Elliot was making his rounds too and talking to some players, that definitely the fact that they're, you know, the families and staff members had taken that charter flight up from Florida that day, like it became a lot more real for them. And this is a group, you know, they got a couple of Stanley Cup winners and Tarasenko, and, you know, Verhaeghe won one as a bit player with Tampa in the bubble in 2020. But this is a group that by large part hasn't won before, and now trying to, you know, one thing to close out a series, it's quite another to close out, you know, a Stanley Cup final. So I think nerves maybe played a role in things, you know, when you've got everybody there and the chance to celebrate Saturday night in Edmonton. But you know, now that it should be a familiar feeling for them going into tomorrow night. And as Paul Maurice said today, you know, it's an opportunity for them to learn from what they went through in game four. So I don't believe they say that the how it all shook out there a couple of nights ago will have an impact on what Florida does. But and it does add certainly some more intrigue here as Edmonton tries to make things more and more interesting.
Kyle, did the way that Bobrovsky got chased, the 8 on the scoreboard, do you think that upset the apple cart in terms of who may emerge as the Conn Smythe winner, regardless of who ultimately goes on to win the series?
I don't think so, Thomas. I don't know. I know that was talked about. I'm sure that it gets talked about a little bit when something like that happens. I don't know. I've never voted on that trophy before, so I don't have a lot of experience, you know, in terms of being actually in it and having to make a decision when the time comes. But I don't believe that it's, and it's funny, like, even if you go back the first couple of rounds, like the hard statistics of save percentage, goals against, and that weren't incredible for him by any stretch. But you just think about the moments that he came up in and some of the big saves at key times that would have given the team a lift. He's been that. And certainly the first three games of this final, that was a bit of a blip. But in game four, and at least as of now, it was. We'll see how things play out from here. But one game like that, I mean, I'm not terribly concerned or feeling like, oh man, I think he just cost himself the MVP, because I mean, I don't think Alexander Barkov was the absolute difference maker on Saturday night that he's been so often through these playoffs too. And likely, you know, if Florida closes this out tomorrow, it's probably going to be one of those two guys. So I think he's very much still in the running despite what happened in game four.
Do you think Edmonton figured anything out in the fourth game, or was this just sort of the flow of results in this series sort of more closely coming to approximate what we've seen throughout?
Yeah, I think, well, it's just some belief that you can score, right? You've found the back of the net a few times. You know, there isn't the same aura or mystique of how are we going to beat this incredibly flexible and acrobatically dynamic goaltender on the other end. You know, they've done it. They got to him. They chased to him. So I think there's a bit of a mental seed there for the Oilers just to feel a little bit good about themselves. I talked with Dylan Holloway for a little bit there after their practice today. He scores a couple of goals, I think first goal since game six against Vancouver in the second round. And, you know, I think for him, of course, you're most pleased with the fact that the team won, but those types of guys, just to see the puck go in individually, it gets the juice flowing again, and the energy goes to your hands and your brain and your legs again. So I think that can help Edmonton here. Certainly now going into game five tomorrow, but to say for Bobrovsky, I think, you know, he did a little bit of media today, and he didn't seem interested at all, nor did he seem to have taken much time over the last 2 days in going through what went wrong for him. And on Saturday, he's very much turned the page. And as we've seen, you know, for the last little while here, as he's kind of reshaped the narrative about him and his career, you know, an off night doesn't seem to linger too much for him.
Yeah, I think we've focused a lot since the game four blowout on kind of the need for Florida to be able to turn the page quickly and move on and, you know, try to close this out tomorrow night on home ice when they have the chance. But I think Edmonton's position here is really fascinating as well, because I think you could make the argument it's maybe not equally important for them to turn the page quickly, but pretty important given that they're still down 3-1 in this series, right? You can't let yourself ride too high off an 8-1 victory for long in game five, or that could be the last game of their season.
Yeah, and I think they've done a good job, at least what we see in here publicly, of at least portraying that. You know, the morning of game four, Chris Knobloch coming out and saying, I'm very much looking forward to the next 10 days we have together. Just having the confidence there, and you know, there's a little behind the scenes clip that the NHL put out there of Zach Hyman in the room before the game, reiterating that unshakable belief. It's just interesting just how, of course, the mind works in these situations, having not, of course, lived that up close and been in the dressing room and trying to turn around a series like this in the situation the Oilers are in. But for them, it's a chance to just extend their time together. And for a lot of this group, it's been longer than just one season that they've been together and been trying to get to this stage. and just not having the pressure anymore, where you're knowing to just go out and play. There's really nothing else to think of other than that. I think that can be a powerful tool as well. So I think tomorrow night's really going to be fascinating, because you know Florida's not likely to have a repeat performance of what they did mm-hmm. in Game 4. You've got to be prepared for that, but also you're more so just thinking about what you can worry about and how you want to play, and going through the feelings and emotions as a player here. It must be really something, particularly on the Edmonton side, because yes, you know, a loss and it's all done and you get nothing after this, you know, wonderful playoff run, but there's still the feeling of no pressure, where you know that's a group on the other side that hasn't closed out a final before, most of those guys in that room, and that's not a small thing either.
You mentioned the commentary from Chris Knobloch before Game 4, and you know, I think back to after Game 3, right, where I know he raised some eyebrows around the league from fans saying, hey, we've shown we can play with them, we've shown we can beat them, despite being down 3-0 in the series. And, you know, it's been interesting watching Knobloch in these playoffs. Obviously, first-time NHL coach, kind of his first time consistently being on the big national stage. He has that very reserved manner, but also that confidence, right, whether it's the 10 days comment that you highlighted or what he had to say after Game 3. What's kind of stood out to you just from getting the chance to repeatedly and consistently cover Chris Knobloch through these playoffs so far?
Yeah, I mean, clearly a competitor, someone who's definitely got, you know, conviction behind, you know, what he believes in, and but does it in a pretty stoic and measured way. And I just thought, you know, as we've seen throughout these playoffs, not afraid to make changes that seem, you know, quite drastic on the surface, and certainly that's not him operating on his own, as he's mentioned, you know, countless times, the amount of people within the organization consults before making the call, but he is the one making that call ultimately, which is not always an easy position to be in. I like that he hasn't been afraid to shake things up in that regard, and for the most part it's worked. So I think it's been a really neat thing for him to, as he's going through all of this for the first time at this level and under this big a spotlight and this much potential scrutiny, that he hasn't shied away from anything. He seems to, I don't know him, of course, particularly well personally, but just having, you know, being to get a chance to chat with him here a little more than I ever would have just within this last month. You know, he seems very much like someone who is not going to waver in how he wants to proceed and what he believes is the best way to go about things, despite things, if they're going well for Edmonton or if they're in a hole, like they're still trying to dig themselves out of now. And I think that kind of permeates through the locker room as well. And you've heard players reference that, and just the way he approaches things help keep that dressing room calm at times. And I think, you know, just from when he first took over back in November, and Stuart Skinner alluded to today and during his media about that was a moment where it either tears you apart as a group or brings you closer together. And, you know, I think he had a big hand in being the voice that they needed to hear at that time. And another example of it here, at least in extending it to a fifth game, I think it's just how he approached the whole situation, and the players very much echoed that same sort of vibe that he had.
Cal, what do you think's on the line legacy-wise for McDavid and Dreisaitl over the balance of this series? I mean, assuming that Florida will find a way to win one more game, did winning one, and winning one as dramatically as they did in Game 4, sort of spare two of the greats in today's game from sort of the ignominy of this being this tremendous playoff run being diminished by how it ended?
Yeah, it's interesting. So Dreisaitl also addressed the media today as well. And I was over at a different part of the rink when he was speaking, but I was told that I guess one of the things he said was, you know, I think whether he said it directly or alluded to the fact that, you know, one of the great things that, you know, the series has continued, of course, it keeps their season alive. And I think for him, I think he's felt he hasn't made the kind of impact in this final that he expects himself to. And now there's another game for him to impact in the way that, of course, helps the team get back into it. And it's what he is, as he said, you know, he's paid to do to step up in big moments. McDavid certainly did that in large stretches with the 4-point night there in game four. And now there's an opportunity for Leon to do something similar here and to chase all of us back to Edmonton for game six. I think, you know, certainly those players, though they would never talk about it publicly, understandably so, but I absolutely believe that's, you know, once it's all said and done, they want that to be part of a career that they won, largely because that's why you get into playing sports, is the, you know, the pursuit of glory and victory and all of that. And of course, I think there's, you know, quietly, you've got to expect that that's going to be something that'll forever be tied to you. And of course, hockey is such a unique one where, you know, it's as great of a player as one may be, it's still such a hard trophy to win and so hard just for one individual to impact the game enough to carry a team all the way to a championship like the Stanley Cup. So I think there is some truth to that for sure. And does it change after just, you know, winning a game four? I don't think so, because as much as it, you know, in the recency bias where you say, wow, what a night that was for Edmonton. You know, if this thing ends tomorrow night, 2 years from now, we're just thinking about the fact that, you know, the Panthers won the cup in five games. And so that's ultimately going to be the takeaway. And so, you know, you never know, right? There's how teams change over the course of the summer. We're entering a situation now where Draisaitl will be eligible for a new contract come July, and what that means going forward for the Oilers. So in the here and now with this team together, I think there's still much to be determined in terms of how this team will be looked back on over time, and whether or not they can continue to chip away here against the Panthers and pull off the improbable.
And Kyle, if the Oilers are able to pull off one more win and send this back to Edmonton in game seven, in addition to every media member complaining about their travel bookings, how much do you think that would change sort of the laissez-faire, friends on in the locker room dynamic that the Panthers were able to front today?
I believe it would. Like, how could it not? How could it not? Like, we had Fernando Pisani on our air just before game four on Saturday. Again, little different situation in 06, like going into Carolina, game five, cups in the building. He scores shorthanded in overtime, send it back for six. And, I mean, Craig Simpson on our broadcast team, he was an assistant coach for that Edmonton squad. And it just said, like, it just changes everything. And they had their best game of the whole year in game six back in Edmonton. I know they, you know, come up short in seven, back in Carolina, but I how can it not? Like, it just, you think about, again, I've never been in that situation as a player. I didn't play at a high enough level to have a chance to, but just you think about the human dynamic where you're sitting pretty up 3-0 and now you're going back to Edmonton. We all saw or felt how wild of an atmosphere that was for game four once they got up and got rolling. Now you're going back into that hornet's nest. You're likely, again, looking at, you know, all the friends and family that you want to have up there traveling and the thought of, oh, my gosh, can you imagine they come all this way a second time and we don't win again? The whole dynamic around that is fascinating to me. And I just, as much as they would certainly portray publicly that, you know, we're all good here. You know, we've got four cracks at this, being up 3-0. You know, you can't tell me that, you know, behind closed doors and the own thoughts that go through someone's mind that they're much different, you know, heading back to Edmonton for game six than even, you know, they would be as they wind down tonight, having a chance to close this thing out on home ice tomorrow.
Yeah, no doubt about it, Kyle. I think the pressure could shift in a hurry if the Oilers are able to win Game 5 tomorrow. Kyle, really appreciate the time. Thank you for doing this, and we'll look for you on the broadcast tomorrow night when the Panthers try to close it out.
Great. Sounds awesome. Thanks for having me, guys. Good to chat with you again.
Yeah, our pleasure. That is Kyle Bukauskas, of course, covering this series as the ringside reporter for Hockey Night in Canada and Sportsnet, weighing in with some of the scenes on the ground in Florida today. And as he said, and as you pointed out towards the end there, very much an effort that, hey, no pressure on us. We're still loose. We're still up 3-1. And fair enough, as I said, they're still up 3-1 in this series. There's a long way to go, despite that dynamic of, man, for more than for the obvious reasons of not wanting to go to Edmonton. You really don't want to have to go back to Edmonton in this series if you're the Florida Panthers.
Oh, Edmonton's not so bad at this time of year, Jamie.
You'd rather be celebrating a Stanley Cup win in South Florida than making the return trip to Edmonton, that's for sure.
The weather in South Florida in June is not good. I'd rather be in Edmonton.
Wow.
No,
all
I'm
right.
Just kidding.
Okay, yeah.
No, but seriously, June, it's like their June is our November. It's very strange.
Like what? So it's not, because I thought you were going to say that it is swelteringly hot there in June, but it's not. Is that what you're saying?
No, you get like a full month of rain and darkness. Mm. Yeah, it's really weird.
That is weird. Anyways, yeah. Still, the Florida Panthers, very, very motivated not to make the trip back to Edmonton,
yes,
after
course.
That game tomorrow. Yeah, and like I do think there's an element of, as I said to Kyle there, yeah, obviously Florida needs to turn the page, but so does Edmonton, right? Like both teams need to try to flush what happened on Saturday and try to just focus on the task at hand in tomorrow night's game. And I do think there's going to be like whoever does that most successfully, can Edmonton match the desperation level they had in Game 4 tomorrow night? That's the question for them, which I think is a lot easier said than done, right? You think, hey, your season's on the line. Of course you're going to be desperate, but one of the reasons teams don't come back from 3-0 deficits very often is it's really hard to have that desperation 4 games in a row. And then I think for Florida, it's just be professional, right? Go out, play your game, shut out the idea of, oh, we're going to lift the cup tonight, the cup's in the building, all of that. And I think whichever team is able to do that more successfully is going to have the best chance at winning tomorrow night.
Yeah, and I had Florida in 5. This is all unfolding according to my plan, and yet I think Florida's been way too dependent on Edmonton making mistakes to generate goals. I find that, like, if your path to winning is Edmonton makes gigantic mistakes and Bobrovsky stops 95% of shots faced, that's a bad plan. Like, the lead that Florida has built is commanding and should be enough. They should have enough margin for error to get this done. I think highly of that team. I thought highly of that team coming in. And yet it feels a little flimsier than I'd like it to. It feels flimsier than I expected it to. I still think with McDavid and Bouchard on the ice, Edmonton's still got the horses that I'd want to bet on in a Game 5.
All right, 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Get your thoughts in, questions you have about the Canucks offseason. Some have come in already that we'll read on the other side. And we've talked about your speed targets on the blue line, but we haven't really got it in to the individual targets at forward, so we have a chance to talk about that a little bit as well. Final segment coming up here on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650.
Hey, it's Vic Nizar. Have your say and join me on The People's Show with big takes and even bigger bets weekdays 3 to 4 on Sportsnet 650 or wherever you get your podcasts.
Wasn't expecting that coming back. It is Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Trantz here. This hour is brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at DLEAMC.com. We're live from the Kintec Studio. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Dunbar Lumber with 3 stores to serve you. in Ladner on Bridge Street or Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center or Arbutus in Vancouver online at DunbarLumber.com. Dom, what this tells me is you have too much time on your hands.
No.
You're bored with your work.
No, not at all.
Responsibilities on your
plate.
We've
got a social post up on Instagram, on X. I just recently found out that BBL Drizzy is license-free music.
You're making the most of it.
I really am.
Well, good for you. All right. As I mentioned, 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. There's a few texts I want to hit here in a second, but we let off the show talking about your latest article up at The Athletic, Drancer, looking at targets the Canucks could add to bolster the speed on the roster. We talked about some of the defensemen earlier in the show and also just kind of conceptually where they most need the extra dose of speed. And you were saying, you know, you see the need more than anything on the blue line at defense. But, of course, some interesting targets out there in terms of forwards as well. And I won't run through the whole list, but a couple of the names that stood out to me for different reasons, because they follow in some ways a template of players we've seen this management group target in the past, not necessarily purely stylistically, but just the kind of type or genre of player. And one of them is Ryan Lomberg, of course, with the Florida Panthers. And the reason that one stood out to me is he hasn't been a regular for this Panthers team in these Stanley Cup finals, although he's played, you know, lots of games for them over the last couple of years. And as you point out, and it certainly reminded me as well, well, that was what Teddy Bluger's situation was, right? After, you know, not playing regularly for the Stanley Cup champion Vegas Golden Knights last year, and maybe that depressed his market a little bit, right? Because you're looking at it and saying, ah, he wasn't even a fourth-line center on this team, but the Canucks were able to get him on an affordable one-year deal and give him a significantly bigger role than he had for Vegas, and they were able to reap the rewards of that. I'm not, obviously, Lomberg's a winger. It's not like a one-to-one replacement or anything like that, but just that idea of, hey, Florida's really, really good. So even if you're not a regular for them in the playoffs, that doesn't mean you can't be a regular for a good team somewhere else, like we saw with Teddy Bluger leaving Vegas last year.
Yeah, and I mean, for me, Lomberg would be, the Lomborghini would be more of a Lafferty replacement than he would be, you know, a Bluger or Joshua replacement.
That's what I'm saying. It's not, they're not the same type of player, but just the same theory behind targeting a guy who wasn't a regular on the likely Stanley Cup champ here.
Well, and I think it matters too. I mean, one thing the Canucks did, you know, in terms of who they signed, I mean, we talked a lot about like size and penalty killing ability, and obviously those hockey impacts are in the driver's seat in terms of guiding the moves from last offseason. But you think about Soucy was with that Kraken overachiever, right? Second round of the playoffs. Bluger was with the Vegas Golden Knights team that won the Stanley Cup. Ian Cole was with the Tampa Bay Lightning. I mean, those were high-quality organizations that the Canucks shopped from, right? I mean, I don't think that's a coincidence. There was a clear – in fact, I know it wasn't. There was a clear desire to, you know, borrow some of the expertise from some of the best and most productive organizations in the league in, you know, in sort of filling out their shopping cart in free agency. So, you know, I think there's value there. I think there's an approach that this management group has shown us that's worth considering. And, you know, I like the idea, as we've talked about, of this club having speedy fourth line options, especially on the wings, given the way that this team plays. But I do think there's value, whether it's Lomberg, who may get back into the lineup for game five based on how the Panthers practice today, or even Kiefer Sherwood.
Mm-hmm.
I do think there's value in finding a fourth line winger. If you're replacing Sam Lafferty, replacing him with a guy who maybe plays to an edgier identity with more consistency. Because I did think ultimately that left Vancouver's fourth line minutes sometimes feeling a bit like Tim Schaller-esque, where it's like they're not going to hurt you, but they're not really building momentum for you consistently either.
Yep.
Maybe not hard enough to play against. Consistently enough, I do think there's an element to which if Vancouver's fourth line can accomplish a little bit more, even if it's not goal scoring, you know, it might give this team a boost. It might be something that helps them.
yeah, that little bit of extra edge, as you said, just bringing something to the table from the bottom of the roster, from the fourth line specifically, right? It's not going to be regular goal scoring necessarily, but do you have that one thing that you can really hang your hat on at the bottom of the lineup? You mentioned Kiefer Sherwood, another of the targets you and Harmon identified as well. Did anyone else stand out or that you want to highlight in terms of potential speedy forward UFA targets for the Canucks?
I mean, I just think Chandler Stephenson, you know, in a world where you're not landing, you know, a Gensel type necessarily,
mm-hmm.
You know, I do like the idea of Stephenson because he can do so many different things for you. I'd almost view it as like a high end version of what Pugh Suter did for the Canucks this past season. You know what I mean? Where it's like he can play wing for you. He can play center. He's a really, really productive 5-on-5 player. So he'd bring a lot more offense than what this team had from some of its supporting pieces. You know, it's not the right-handed, like, penalty-killing ace centerman that ideally you'd find, right? It's not like a Lindholm replacement. But I think it suits, you know, some of the, like, optionality and play style that made this team effective last season. I think there's, you know, some meaningful value there. So Stephenson for me would be the other name to highlight as like a, you know, sort of a fallback option, as it were, for if this team's not able to land like the biggest possible fish. I still think Stephenson would punch up this offense and fit in with how this team wants to play.
It worries me a little bit. As you said, if it's a fallback option, I think we had this conversation last week, right? Like, there are no true fallback options to Jake Gensel on the UFA market, right? In terms of adding that true top end at the top of your lineup, like, I worry, I like Chandler Stephenson as a player, right? But if it's like, we struck out on Gensel, let's go get Stephenson, I worry about that turning into a mistake contract down the road.
Yeah, and, you know, I was thinking about it over the weekend and looking over lists, and I've been saying Jake Gensel's one of one a lot in terms of assessing top of the lineup options in free agency. And I think I want to amend that. I still think he's one of one, but I do think there's a meaningful 1B.
Okay.
And it's Jonathan Marchessault.
All right.
Now, he's 34.
Yep.
So we're looking at a slightly different level of risk if you're going term and money. But I don't know that the gulf between Gensel and Marchessault is so big that Gensel's one of one so much as he's 1A. 1A of one. And Marchessault's 1B. He scored 40 goals this past season. Mm-hmm. Like, over the last 3 years, Marchessault ranks in the top 30 among all NHL forwards in goals per game rate. The only Canucks forward with a higher 5-on-5 scoring clip than Marchessault is Nils Höglander over the last 3 years. And Marchessault's done it in, like, an extra 1,500 minutes. You know, he's also top 30 in the league in shot rate. Like, we're talking about a guy who has matched William Nylander and Matthew Tkachuk's goal scoring rate over the last 3 seasons at even strength. When you think about what this team needs, you know, the grit that Marchessault is capable of playing with too. Yeah, I mean, I do think that he would be the other guy, but, you know, I don't know if Vancouver would consider that or what have you, but I do think it's worth noting. There really are kind of like two superstar level top of the lineup fits, in my view. I do think we have to discuss Marchessault in those terms.
It's a fair point. I've almost been relegating Marchessault to like the Sam Reinhart, he's a UFA, but not actually type of tier, right? Because I do think he's going to end up in Vegas. But having said that, we all know how ruthlessly or how ruthless Vegas can be with their players, right? Like, they're not shy about moving on, even from really, really core guys who are important to that franchise. I would still bet on Marchessault working it out and staying in Vegas, but I think with that franchise, you never know. And it's a fair point. Look, the cost and the age and the risk is an interesting thing. One similarity with him and Gensel is, you know, not big players, either of them, but zero doubts about, obviously, about their ability to perform in the playoffs. Marchessault, of course, winning the Conn Smythe last year. So that's an interesting one. If you do strike out on Jake Gensel and he's out there, he's on the open market, that might be a plausible way to try to add that juice to the top of your lineup.
Yeah, and I also just think, like, so if we're talking about the real impact superstar adds, okay? So we're talking about Gensel realistically on the open market, right? Mm-hmm. We're probably not talking about Jonathan Marsh, so we're talking about Gensel.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're talking about, like, your Ehlers, Marner tier,
yep.
Pavel Buchnevich tier guys, the guys who come at massive acquisition cost. Well, this organization wasn't willing to trade Elias Pettersson, the defenseman, Villander, and Lekkerimäki at the deadline last year. You know, I've been talking about the idea that maybe they should be willing to trade the 2025 first with some protection on it. I could see them doing that given, you know, the less need of it all in terms of how this organization operates. But for our listeners who don't know, Les Snead is the general manager of the Los Angeles Rams, mm-hmm. a team that loves to trade draft picks and mortgage the future. And at their Super Bowl winning parade, famously yelled to the crowd, F them draft picks. So that's the Les Snead of it all. It is very much a Canucks special. So, you know, those players are expensive. And then you're kind of getting into like the hopeful bet tier, your Lion A, Zegras tier, right? Or you're getting into like the Kotkaniemi, Greenway, you know, project a guy to be more for you down the line, right? I guess Martin Natchez, his name should be thrown in there too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at some point, given this team's asset weaponry, what they actually have to deal, you know, are you not better off cobbling together some things, right? Like, are you not better off keeping some powder dry, right? Waiting to see, maybe Villander has a bit of a pop sophomore season and, you know, maybe his trade value spikes, maybe a unique opportunity comes along, maybe you keep some cap space available. You know, because I do think you need winger help for Pettersson. And I think ideally you'd get really high-end winger help for Pettersson. But, you know, I don't know that like a Stevenson type who raises your floor in so many different ways and gives you like, you know, a really prolific 5-on-5 rate scorer in addition to a lot of other things. Like, I don't know that like that and another move for another versatile guy. Now I'm going to bring up another Golden Knight because he's become my guy over the years. I don't know when it happened, Jamie, but it's happened. Like an Amadio type.
Let's go. Love Mike Amadio.
Well, and you know, increasingly like this team is ruthlessly attacked, and we've talked about it so much, ruthlessly attacked their floor
mm-hmm.
in a variety of ways. And it's worked really well, especially I think because their core players all had phenomenal seasons all at the same time, especially for the first 4 or 5 months of the year, and because of how well coached they are and because of how well this team defends now. You know, the one thing about their scoring, the one area of floor that they really didn't have, especially after, you know, parting ways with Kuzmenko, it felt, was you'd get all these minutes that are, you know, Pettersson with Lafferty, Pettersson with Mikheyev with Miller and Pettersson in game 7. You had Phil DiGiuseppe with Besser and Miller. Like, you had all these moments in the season where you had a really weak link offensive producer playing a little too high up the lineup. And by the way, I have time for all of those players individually, right? It's just, if you're asking them to score goals for you sustainably in your top six, like, you know, Alvin said it himself, right? Like, with Mikheyev, right? Like, that's on me, right? Well, Amadio's a guy who you can plug and play basically anywhere in your top nine, left wing, right wing, center. You know, you don't probably want him playing top six center, but if you need him to play third line center for a bit, he can do it. And it's like, he's the guy you can put with Miller and Besser, and he's not going to hurt them defensively in any way, shape, form, or otherwise, even if he's not going to like help them as much as Pugh Suter. And he's not going to fritter away scoring opportunities at the rate that like a DiGiuseppe or Mikheyev is, right? Like, he's got more offensive pop than that. You know, there's utility to having Mario and Mario Party. There's a utility to having that versatility, raising your floor in terms of how you plug and play players throughout your lineup. And the Canucks already have some with Pugh Suter. It's
mm-hmm.
it's one of the reasons why, like, I don't know if it's tomorrow or Wednesday, but at some point we're going to run our UFA targets list for third line centermen. And it's like three names long. Right? Like, it's bad. And yet the Canucks can't panic about it because you've got Pugh Suter. You know, you enter next season with a Suter, Mikheyev, Hoglander third line. I'm going to keep saying it. You're fine. It's fine. Is it great? No. Is it fine? It's fine. It's not going to make the difference between you missing the playoffs or not. You're just going to want to acquire a body or two to bolster that group before you get to the postseason if you think you have a shot. So, you know, I do think this team has options, and if they don't land the biggest fish, you know, I still think the volume approach that they took last offseason is instructive. Attack your floor, and attack your floor in terms of the offensive side of the puck this time, right? Like, make it so that even if you have an injury or two, even if one guy runs cold for a bit, make it so that you're not plugging in Mikheyev onto your top line in the most important game of the year. Make it so that Lafferty is not your second choice, you know, second line winger. I actually think you can hit pretty significant dividends by just having like competent offensive options as opposed to the star that ideally, you'd find a way to land.
Well, I'll say the other thing about, okay, what do they do if they strike out on Guentzel and, you know, you kind of have that money set aside in terms of your cap planning. Maybe you had to let some UFAs of your own walk in order to open up that space. You don't get them. Yes, they need that star winger, but we've talked about they need another defenseman as well, right? So I wouldn't even look at it as, okay, how do we fall back and find a top six forward instead of Jake Guentzel, right? Like, to me, it's, where's the biggest impact we can get? And maybe it's on the blue line, right? Like, I don't think Brandon Montour is a fit at that cost, but if you are a believer in Brady Shea, if you're a believer in Sean Walker, nope. You go down the list, right? Like, nope. Brett Pesce, but whatever the case is, you know
okay,
what I mean?
Yes.
Matt Roy.
You hit on one.
Matt Roy, right.
I think there's only one.
That's fine. But if it's Brett Pesce, whatever, yeah. Like, it's whatever management thinks, right? Like, to me, if you miss out on Jake Guentzel, you don't have to go get a winger to replace Jake Guentzel. You have to go get somebody who moves the needle for you at whatever position it is. Maybe it's Brett Pesce, right? And I'm not even saying, then trade Filip Pronik. Just use that money you had set aside for Jake Guentzel on a third defenseman that you feel really good about in your lineup.
And maybe I'm too harsh on Brady Shea. I mean, he's 6'3" and he's a really strong skater, and he had 47 points with the Carolina Hurricanes and isn't like dependent on the power play. Like, obviously a perfectly good player, but I don't know. There's a type of defenseman, like they're good and they're physically impressive, but they're not very high IQ that I'm often pretty critical of. And yet, you know, I think there's a few players that match that description that the Canucks had a lot of success with this season. So, you know, maybe it's like, I didn't love the Shea pickup for Carolina. It's been a home run for them. He's been like a 40-point guy every year.
Yeah.
While also being 6'3", 210 pounds and fast as heck. So, you know, kudos, right? Like, those players can work for sure. But I do think Pesce is materially different in terms of being like a bona fide top of the lineup guy, you know, of the caliber that I think we're talking about.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not pitching for an individual player here. I'm just saying conceptually, if you think there's a top of the lineup defenseman, like that can be what you do with the Guentzel money if you don't get Guentzel, right? Because you still need the talent at that part of your lineup as well. Andrew for and sure. Langley texted in earlier, given that this roster won't be in its perfect form and ready for the playoffs in October due to cap reasons, what area are you most comfortable leaving a bit imperfect until the trade deadline? Give some examples, third line center, bottom pairing D-man, or a top line winger for Petey. Is it third line center and hoping Pugh Suter can hold his own? To me, this is pretty simple. Like, you need to get the highest up the lineup stuff figured out first, because that's the most difficult to do, and it's definitely the most difficult to do in season. You can tweak the bottom of your roster, especially like a 5-6 defenseman. Those guys move all the time. We saw they got Nikita Zadorov for what, a third and a fourth this year. I'm not saying you're going to get somebody who brings that same type of impact to your blue line, but those deals are always out there.
But you might.
You might. You never know. So for me, it's pretty easy. Like, get the star talent, especially the winger for Patterson, figured out. Everything else is so much easier to do. Third line center would be next, right? Because that's inherently harder. Premium position, all of that. But it's pretty simple. It's just the higher up the lineup the hole is, the more you have to do it before the season starts. Because once the season starts, it becomes really, really complicated.
I slightly disagree with you in that I actually think there's really good buying opportunities in season. And I think some of the teams that have done best at the trade deadline over the last few years, Vegas and Boston, especially have used the sort of the deadline and in season to do long-term shopping. I'm thinking Hampus Lindholm. I'm thinking Charlie Coyle. I'm thinking
Noah Hanifin,
you know, obviously Thomas Hurdle, Hanifin. go down the list. I mean, Eichel was an in-season ad. Like the Golden Knights have done that because when those weird opportunities shake loose and everyone else has their cap space already tied up, that limits the amount of buyers, which limits the demand, which, you know, decreases the price and can put you in a good position. Now, this is sort of where the dynamic of this team overall, right? The, you know, selling hope of it all, and this organization's, you know, trademark impatience kind of commingles with what's best here, right? Like, given everything that happened around this club last season, given the smash success, given the reinvigoration of this madcap hockey market and its infatuation with this franchise, can you afford to be quiet this offseason? Mm-hmm. Right? Probably not.
Yep.
Right? Can you go into next season, or can you go into August with $5 million, $8 million in cap space, right? Not having spent to the cap.
Yeah, and especially, you know, like while Zadorov and Joshua went elsewhere, potentially, in that example, right? Like that.
While you're only
that are,
UFA,
yeah.
Potentially you're the only UFA you keep is Tyler Myers.
Yep.
I mean, is that something this organization's comfortable with? Because if that happens, by the way, they're going to be getting filleted, like probably by me as well, right? because it can be hard for people to understand what's in front of their face as it's sort of unfolding in real time. And, you know, yet I actually kind of wonder if that's, again, if you're really big game hunting, right? If you're really big game hunting, like I have no problem with them taking a pretty similar volume approach, responsible, low cost bets, low term bets. You know, they've done so well buying from the discount bin that, like, I have no problem with them just going out and, you know, finding a bunch of like Die Hard 3 VHSs and sort of building out their team in that manner and keeping their powder dry if the right opportunity to land an impact player doesn't present itself. Because, you know, we see how this goes every year. Those unique opportunities do come about in season more often than not. You know, I don't think that's the worst play for the Canucks if they're really intent on finding like the game-changing pieces we're talking about, that first line defender or first pair defender, that first line yeah. winger.
The other thing with that approach is you have to go into the season knowing you're willing to part with your premium future assets, right? Like that has to be on the table.
Oh yeah.
Because otherwise you're not getting those players. So that you have to build that in before the opportunity even arises to the way your team is thinking, right? Because you never know when it's going to happen. You have to go into the season knowing that Lekaramäki and Villander and the first round pick are on the table, and if you're willing to put those on the table in season, well, you should be willing to put them on the table in the summer as well to see if you can't get a jump on anything that might be out there. Although, as you said, in season sometimes the prices are lower because there's fewer teams that are capable of making a deal happen. All right. Thank you to everyone for texting in. We're going to wrap up the show there. We will be back tomorrow. Game 5 of the Stanley Cup Final goes tomorrow in Florida. The Panthers trying to win the first Stanley Cup in franchise history. The Oilers trying to prolong the series and send it back to Edmonton. So we'll have coverage of that. And of course, whatever list gets published on The Athletics, on the Canucks section of The Athletics, we'll have coverage of that on the show tomorrow as well. I can guarantee that. Thanks for listening. Keep it right here on Sportsnet 650.